Welcome to Halloween H4O Talk Film Society's retrospective on the 11 films in the Michael Myers series, even the one where Michael Myers just appears on TV, which we'll be talking about next week. But I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me is my good friend, Zach Moore. How are you doing, Zach?
I'm doing well. Brandon, I got shot seven times maybe, depending on which version of the movie you watch, but I'm feeling good. I'm on the lookout for Laurie Strode.
Excellent. Right on. Your sister. I love it.
Twist. Is it? We'll talk about that.
And joining us, we have a very special guest for this second episode, our good friend John Mills from the Nerd Party Network and his show Great Shot Kid. How are you doing, John?
I am thrilled to be here. I'm ignoring all of the warnings about being on this show right now and nonchalantly ignoring all of the danger signs.
Yeah, it's a very dangerous thing to be on this podcast. So, but that's okay. Well, Zach and I last episode kind of gave our history of how we came into the Halloween series. But John, I know that Halloween movies are very special for you. So why don't you give us a little bit of the history of the Halloween franchise?
Oh, my goodness. For me, it starts the Halloween when I was 10 years old and coming back from trick-or-treating. And there they were on television, Halloween and Halloween 2, actually. Okay. So I wound up they were on two different channels. And so I wound up seeing the first one. And then I think the second one started shortly before the first one ended. So I was like flipping between the channels while it was going on, scared the living bejeebers out of me. Still to this day, if I hear the music at night, I tense up. The joke with the missus is I will always say, come on, the kids can watch horror movies. I started when I was 10 years old and I turned out okay. And then she points out, yes, and you still jump at shadows and can't sit in a dark room. And I'm like, well, yeah, there are downsides. But I became obsessed with Michael Myers and owned a mask, actually. When I was 14 or 15, went trick-or-treating with my younger cousins dressed as Michael Myers.
Nice.
And infected them with the fear. And there was I'll close with just a cute little story that there was one point, I think it was my cousin Tim, where I was staying over at his house, and I brought the mask over to scare him. I got him, ha ha, we all had a good laugh. And I left the mask on the back of like a chair and went home. And and then he told me like a week later that the night after I had left, he woke up and the mask was like looking back at him, and he just nearly hit the ceiling. He like screamed so loud that he woke up his folks. So I can proudly say that I've seen every film in the series. So
excellent. Awesome. Right on. Yeah. Well, tonight we're here talking about Halloween 2, which is the sequel. And the first thing that I want to talk about with this is the interesting idea that this film takes place immediately after the first film. And I was trying to rack my brain, and the only other movie that I could think of that may be something that takes place immediately after that I could think of would be The Matrix 3. But I mean, like, it's been so long since I've seen that may not even be exactly after.
And I think you're missing a big one, Brandon.
Am I? Which one?
Star Wars, The Last Jedi.
So does The Last Jedi takes place immediately after The Force Awakens?
Yes-ish. Well,
for Rey, it does. Yes-ish. I don't know about everybody else. But.
Yeah, there's a little bit of juxtaposition of time and space at the beginning, because if you go with the outside source materials, I think you are led to believe that the stuff with the resistance takes place 2 days later. And so the idea would be that the opening with Poe and his delightful prank call routine happens as Rey is on the way to Octo.
Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, that's not just even immediately after, but, I guess.
So Halloween 2, The Last Jedi of the Halloween yes. franchise. That's not controversial at all in this day and age. No, but that's a great point, Brandon, because, yeah, that's
there's
a very
many.
interesting decision to make, because you can't, you kind of lock your, as we found in Star Wars Last Jedi, right? You lock yourself into certain story choices and decisions because you can't really reset the characters in the way lots of other sequels are able to.
Right, right. And a common trope with horror films is the bad guy gets away at the end. Like, they kill him, but he's not really dead, you know, and there's always some little thing to indicate that this person's still alive, you know, whether it's Freddy or Jason or Michael Myers. And there's an opening for a sequel. And most of the sequels take place a significant amount of time later, with other characters generally as well, like a whole new cast of characters. You might get the main character to come in for some type of secondary role or something like that, a cameo appearance, but generally the format changes. And with Halloween being such a groundbreaking film and basically defining the slasher genre, it's interesting that the sequel is never really repeated, this type of opening for the sequel. So you can watch these movies back to back, and this could be a 3-hour film. What do you think about that, Zach?
I think it's interesting because they do work together, but this part two is not necessary for you to enjoy part one. Like, part one is completely self-contained, you know? If there was never another sequel, and that's, you know, that could be debated, like, should there have been other sequels to Halloween? But it was so successful, a sequel was inevitable, right? It's interesting. It's one of those, like we were talking about last episode, choose your own canon, choose your own continuity. You can watch the first one by itself, and that's fine. You can watch the second one and the first one together. It isn't like an extremely long movie, because it does feel like it literally is the same night. It just continues on. And it does inform and recontextualize some things from the first one. It also adds in some new twists and whatnot. And I think for Halloween being one of the groundbreaking, you know, horror movies of all time, I think for a sequel having to follow up, this one does a fine job, and it's a satisfying continuation of the story that we saw in the first film.
Mm-hmm. John?
I've always had a fondness for Halloween 2, and I do agree with you, Zach. If you're going to follow it up, then this is a great way to do it. And kudos to them for making it work and making it into, you know, I will throw in there that it does something that I don't think that any other horror series of the time period really manages to do, which is it actually deepens the story and makes it more interesting. It's really not just a rehash. I mean, in many ways it is just a rehash of what made the first one work, but it at least decides to make a story choice here or there that makes it more interesting and makes you say, oh, okay. I mean, like, every good sequel should improve or inform something about the previous one that says to you, this is why you should care about this. And I, you know, and it's tough because there are things that as I've gotten older are easier for me to complain about with two, but I still have that fondness because I still think that there are, once it finds its feet again, especially, it gets really scary once it's at the end at the hospital and, you know, and he's going around. And I mean, there's one shot that still absolutely haunts me from the hospital. And so, you know, you got to give it credit. And it has the courage to, you know, at the time, be very final about everything. So,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, like, we will end up spoiling this film. I'm assuming everybody's seen it here. There's quite a few things that I want to talk about with this movie, and I think that the first thing that we should talk about is the Laurie Strode ending up being his sister. Now, for me, I've always enjoyed that portion of the storyline, and that's always worked for me because of how the Halloween series starts with him killing Judith Myers at the beginning of the first film and killing his first sister. So my interpretation of what happened in that and Michael Myers' justification for killing his sister. Now, a lot of people might just say, look, he's just a killer. There's no justification. We don't need the justification. But with the films that I've had and how I came to it, he justified himself in killing his sister because she's promiscuous. She's supposed to be babysitting him and she's sleeping with this guy instead. So something snaps in his mind. Maybe this is something that's a frequent occurrence and, you know, he just snaps and kills his sister. And then we have Laurie Strode being another sister, And he just can't make that differentiation. And so that's how I've always interpreted this. And it's always been a plot line that works for me. John, how do you feel about that?
I think it's a great way to switch things up and catch the audience off guard and give a motivation that still works with the first one. But it's an inspired choice, but I wouldn't necessarily say that it works as completely as I'd like it to, simply because a lot of the thrill of the first one is pondering why did he choose these people. And the thing is, you can tell why he chose these people to go after.
Right.
There exactly. is a motivation on top of everything. But then adding this makes it, you know, I don't dislike it, but I can definitely see where there would be the complaint of, did you really need to? And I would say, as you go back over to when you get that reveal, there are then some choices that he makes. You know, the girl that he kills, you know, on the way after he picks up the knife, right, from the old woman, freaks her out. Oh,
doesn't
my gosh.
Doesn't kill the old people, though. Doesn't kill them.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And therefore, his motivation for just like, oh, hey, look, somebody else, and like walk in and kill her. It's like, well, that's their motivation is not. She had no reason to do that, you know, that sort of thing. Like, all of Laurie's friends was obviously part of, like, this big elaborate thing to get her, whereas, you know, a choice like that is like, the audience needs a killing. And it's like, oh, okay, sure.
Zach, what do you think about Sister Strode?
Well, I'm aligned a lot with what you're saying, John. I feel like it is a little bit of universe shrinking. You know, there is some mystery to the first film, like what he's doing, you know, and he's just going around doing his thing. And it's not because of one thing or the other, specifically these people. Like in this movie, they do kind of recontextualize, because at the, you know, Laurie's like, why me? It's like, well, you were there at the, like, he didn't like come find you specifically. You kind of inserted yourself into the situation. Had she not gone across the street, who knows what would happen, right? Michael had fulfilled that need to reenact his sister's death with her friends, and he's got the tombstone on the bed. You know, that was kind of a complete thing. I don't know. What is it with the 80s and making like characters siblings, right? It's the same thing talking about Star Wars again, right? It's Luke and Leia, Michael and Laurie, right? I think in this two-part movie, right, that works, right? But I think, you know, this is later on down the road, like when they keep bringing this whole family connection in the sequels over and over and over, that has kind of retroactively tainted, because this is where it all started, right? Before he was the boogeyman, he could come after anyone, anywhere. The end of the first film is shots of the town, you hear the breathing, he could be anywhere on any Halloween, right? Mm-hmm. This one kind of says, oh, well, the sister's his whole motivation, right? And you're like, oh, okay, well, and then the story ends, and you're like, okay, fine. But then when they keep retreading it over and over, I think that's when it really gets tired. I'm cool either way with it, right? Like I said, the first film, if you just want to say he's a killer, he's a serial killer, and there's no relation to these people, he's just out there, they're people in his path, that's one thing. The second one, you're like, oh, now I see why he did certain things at certain times. That works too. But end it there. You know, don't go on and on about daughters and sisters and nieces and all that as they go on in the sequels. So I see strengths and weaknesses either way, and I do give the movie credit for going out of its way to say, oh no, these are really secret files that even Dr. Loomis didn't know, and they just released them today, because you think, how would Loomis not know that he had another sister, right? That's a huge, I would say that's a huge plot hole that the movie goes out of its way to fix. So all that being said, I'm going with where you're taking this movie on that. So
okay. Awesome, yeah, because that's something I've always enjoyed, and like we pointed out last episode, when we watched the trailer for the new movie, it looks like they're retroactively doing Halloween 2 again and completely eliminating that plot line, because one of the characters in the trailer for the new film says, isn't she his sister? And they're like, no, that's just an urban myth.
Well, we've had 40 years of that being the case, or you know whatever, 37 years, right, of that being the case. I feel like that whole plot line has been explored to death, right? Yeah. No pun intended. So let's explore the other branch of they're not related, right? That's why I'm actually very excited about that change for H4O.
Excellent. Now, we'll bring this up next here, because I messaged the both of you, and I posted on my Facebook and Twitter streams that I ranked these first three films on Letterboxd, and you know, upon multiple rewatches of the show, I gotta say, I think I enjoy Halloween 2 more than Halloween. It's not necessarily a better made film, but I think I enjoy it more. And one of the reasons why I like horror sequels, especially from the ones from the 80s, is because of the death count being elevated and the extremely creative ways that they kill them. And I understand that for a lot of people, this takes away something from Michael Myers. And I'm just wondering what you guys think of that. John, we'll start with you again.
I don't like the more graphic approach that they take with things in this. And I think that Halloween 2 at certain points, with the way that it pursues the kill, winds up falling victim of copying its own imitators.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, Friday the 13th's whole bag was, but he kills her with this. And it's like, oh, okay, hey, jump scare. Whereas, you know, like the first Halloween, Michael's extremely quiet and methodical, and it's all just a lesson in tension building. And then this one is, you know, again, it's just right out of the gate. It's like, oh, here's somebody and kill them. And, oh, and let's kill them with a hot tub. And let's kill. And it's like, it seems like there's a little bit too much creativity. I don't think that it's as much of a problem as the other horror films in the time period. But I do, you know, especially with how restrained the first one was, this one feels like it indulges in its gratuity a little bit much.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that, John. It's interesting that, you know, Rick Rosenthal, who directed Halloween 2, he didn't put this gore in there because he was trying to keep in the spirit of the original. And then John Carpenter saw it and was like, we need some more gore. And you know, he did some reshoots. Rick Rosenthal, say that three times fast, wasn't too happy with because he thought it kind of betrayed the whole, like, angle that the Halloween franchise was about. And as you said, they that's a perfect way to put it. They're a victim of copying their own copycats. You know, they're like, oh, well, these franchises are doing it now. The gore level, the people expect gore in a rated R horror movie now. If we don't give it to them, they're going to be disappointed. I would argue that, no, that's what kind of set the first one apart. Yep. And yes, it was, and but I do see your point, Brandon. It is a little more entertaining, like, oh, what's he gonna kill her with next, right?
Yeah.
But it's not in this, it's much more like Friday the 13th than Halloween as far as what the first film had established. And to your point about two being better than one, I disagree. I think one is still the gold standard for this franchise.
Mm-hmm. Totally with you, Zach.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I just did a double check while you guys were talking here, and between Halloween and Halloween 2, we had the release of both Friday the 13th and Friday the 13th Part 2, right? And so part of their shtick is the crazy deaths. But, I mean, that is something that I really do enjoy about this film. Like, when he gets that cop in the head with the hammer, I'm like when I see these things, like, I laugh when I watch these, right? I'm like, yeah. And I'm laughing as I watch them because it's so creative and it's so enjoyable. And it is elaborate. But that's part of the thing that I really enjoy about this movie. A lot.
I will say, you know, probably my, you know, if you want to say favorite death, I know it sounds morbid, right? But these are horror movies, right? My favorite death, if you will, in the first one would be when he's dressed up as the ghost, you know, and she thinks it's her boyfriend, right? And I feel like the spiritual successor to that in Halloween 2 is the hot tub death, right? Yeah. Where he's like walking up behind, I forget the character's name, but the nurse who's always late, and like puts his hand on her shoulder and she starts like caressing it and kissing it. It's like this slow build. I'm like, well, come on, lady, wake up. You know, by the time she turns around, she's like, too late, you missed your chance. And he rips his hand away. It's kind of funny. It shows little bits of character in this completely blank character of Michael Myers in these little scenes. And I find that like the most entertaining death in this film. Although the scalding water, oh my God, what a horrible way to die. Very gruesome.
Yeah, you know, if we're going to talk about deaths that have an effect, it's definitely for me got to be when he's playing dead in the hallway of the hospital, and the cop is next to him. He's like, no, he's down.
He's stopped
breathing. Loomis is like, get away from him. And it's you know, that's probably my favorite one because I think that one is the easiest for me to you know, identify with Loomis of the whole thing. It's like, well, no, you stay far away from this thing until it's on fire and dead and everything else. So,
right. Now, I guess this is probably a good time to do our death count for the film. So as we go along, we're going to be doing a combined total and whatnot. And Zach, I do have to retroactively fix something from our first episode, because he actually killed two dogs in the movie because he ate one of them.
Oh, you're right. Oh, yes. That's awful.
So we got five people and two dogs from the first film. And in this one here, there's a couple clarifications that we got to make. Okay, so while we're going through this here, I've classified it as nine people, one shrapnel death, and a retcon death, and a maybe. So let's go over these one by one. So this maybe death. Now, there's a deleted scene.
Oh, with the last Starfighter, right?
The Jimmy guy. Yeah, the guy from the last Starfighter. So Jimmy, did Jimmy die in the film? In the deleted scene, he didn't, and there's like this hilarious scare where he sits up in the back of the ambulance and scares Lori, and we see that he's alive.
There were a lot of fake scares in this movie, by the way. Did you guys notice that? Like, cats jumping out of dumpsters.
Yes. Yep. We talked about that with our Jonesy from Alien, the Jonesy's jump.
Sorry to interrupt you, Brandon, but that just reminded me of that. But go ahead,
Yes. So, Jimmy, do we consider him dead? Like, I don't know, going farther than this.
No, I don't think so. Because he slipped and fell in some blood, right? So he had a little concussion, right? And then he stumbled out to a car and kind of passed out. Like, this movie has gone out of its way to brutally kill people. Since they didn't do that, I'd say he's alive.
I know that there is the alternate cut of it, and it is lodged very much in my brain, because there is a cut of this where it is pretty definitive that he is dead. And it's, it's one of those things where I don't know if they've ever released a TV cut of this, but I do know that there was some alternate version that they put out on television. Probably because of the during the time period, you couldn't show as much on TV and that sort of thing. But I know that there is a version where when the explosion, he either buys it when the explosion goes off at the end, and he gets, and it's supposed to be implied that he got killed in the explosion. Or the official version that, it's, the slipping on the blood and so on and so forth.
Excellent. Well, neither here or there. It's not that big a deal. So let's call him as not dead. Let's just say he's not dead. So I'll take him off the list. Now, I got to ask about this. So I was doing some research. I was trying to write down as I was watching the film, and I'm like, man, this is way too many people whose names I just don't know. So I'm going to have to search online. So I looked online and I found a website that has a nice listing of everything, horror.wiki.com. And it's a list of deaths in the Halloween series. And they mention in here Alan Gateway's son. And I'm like, what is this? And a tab over it says that this is something that's mentioned in the fourth film. So it's like something that's mentioned in dialogue as another person that we never saw die. But in the fourth movie, he's given credit as a retroactive death that also
we can count that when we get there. I don't think we should count it yet.
Okay, so we'll leave that and we'll talk about that in the fourth one. Then we've got nine dead people and a shrapnel death. And the shrapnel death I call, because it's not Michael Myers killing the person, it's something else that happened in the film. And that's Ben Tramer.
Oh, he's dead for sure.
He's dead for sure, right? When he gets run over by the police. That is amazing. Like, this guy's, like, running away from the cop. He's looking over his shoulder. He gets hit by a car and just crushed exploded. Like, that's amazing.
Can we talk about that
amazing
scene?
It's awesome.
For a second, first of all, it is amazing, right? But that cop, would he have hit that car anyway? Like, he would.
Right? It's a great question. That is a great question.
He goes full into that car. It explodes, as we know all cars do in movies if they're hit. And then also, why is Ben Tramer dressed exactly like Michael Myers, right? Nobody knows what Michael Myers looks like. He might have bought that mask at the same shop, but why is he wearing, like, the overalls, or at least blue? I don't know. Ben Tramer had some bad luck that night. It's all I got to say. He's been wearing that.
Although I will say that, thankfully, it gives us, the series of events gives us the opportunity to see a very young Dana Carvey, which is always a treat.
Yes, Dana Carvey, his Hollywood premiere in this film.
Yeah, what? Well, once I was old enough to recognize him when I went back like years and years ago, and I was like sitting there just watching, I was like, Dad, oh my God, that's Dana Carvey.
Who is he in this film? I didn't notice.
He's a cameraman with the reporter. He's outside, I guess, the Myers house, is it? When they're doing the riot.
So. Yeah.
And then he's at the end when Laurie's getting, you can't really see him at the last scene. But he's just got a camera in front of his face because he's the cameraman when she gets inside the ambulance. But he's also at the Myers house during the riot, and he's the one the reporter's like, "I want you to talk to parents. If you can't find parents, find me a quote." And he's there.
That's
going
to go on to
star
in Wayne's
World
with Mike
Myers. So it's all connected.
Oh wow! I got to go back and check that out. I didn't notice. That's awesome. So anyway, so we got an awesome shrapnel death, and which I also got to say, I don't know if you guys caught. I mean, after all these, this is the guy that Laurie Strode had the hots for.
Mm-hmm.
In the first film, right? So I think Pardon me?
They closed off that plot line, huh?
They sure did. Yeah, that's for sure. So then we got nine other people. So we got Alice Martin with a knife in the chest, Bernard Garnett with a hammer, Bud Scarlotti strangled with a cord, Nurse Bailey was scalded to death, Dr. Mixter with a syringe in the eye. I gotta love drunk Dr. Mixter. Right?
Like, coming
from his Halloween party, hammered and performing medicine. Plus the ambulance driver smoking up in the lunchroom, smoking up weed in the lunchroom.
It was awesome. A different time, Brandon.
It was a different time. Nurse Marshall with a syringe with her air in the brain.
Like,
that is so amazing. I just love this movie. These deaths are so great.
You're a sick man, Brandon.
Okay. Nurse Alvis drained of blood, Nurse Franco with a knife in the back, and Terrence Gummel with his throat slit. So, yes. Yeah, so
and Dr. Loomis blows up, right?
Well, he doesn't die, though. He comes back. So,
I would say at the end of the film, right, I think one of the deputies asked the other, how many are dead? He says 10, right? I think he was counting Loomis as one of the 10 and not Ben Tramer because Myers didn't kill him. So,
hey, you write down whatever you want, man. You pick your own.
You know,
your own death count.
I had the argument about reboots and retcons and stuff like that, and I love to cite Halloween where I'm like, Loomis is dead until later in the 1980s when they determined that Halloween 3 didn't work out the way they'd hoped, and they decided he didn't die in that explosion, and it's
also didn't get burned very badly.
He had some scars.
He had some makeup. There's less and less makeup as the series progresses, but yes.
Yeah.
He has less burning than the cigarette smoking man in like the reboot of the X-Files, right? So, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got 14 people, two dogs, and a shrapnel death of Ben Tramer. So that's our running total of deaths in the Halloween series so far. Excellent.
Can we talk about Jamie Lee Curtis's awful wig in this movie?
It's a wig?
Shh. No. No, we can't talk about the wig. Don't draw attention to the wig, Zach. Come on. Just go with it, okay?
Oh, man.
Yeah. No, that's... the wig is... Although you got to give them credit for having the wisdom to have her wear the wig in the pickup shots that created the TV version of Halloween. So that if you watch the TV version of Halloween, it creates some hair... issues there where it's like, okay, well, it always allowed me to sort of just like buy into it and just be like, okay, I'll go along with it now.
I plant those seeds. Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly. And, and it's, I got to be honest with you that with the apparently, getting rid of Halloween 2 with the new one that's coming out, I don't know. I really like the TV cut of Halloween an awful lot. And I'm going to have to say a very difficult farewell to it because I'm pretty sure that it invalidates some of the stuff that happens in that too, which is a darn shame.
Well, exploring some of that, like, do you think Laurie Strode knew that Michael Myers was her brother?
Well, in this, she finds out in this film in Halloween 2.
Well, I think she always knew because
she would have to.
Yeah, because she does.
I'm sorry, Zach. Go on. Yeah,
no, go ahead.
It's a repressed memory that comes to her in a drug induced. Haze.
Mm-hmm.
And so she discovers it, quote unquote, but it's really her rediscovering what's going on.
Because she has a specific flashback of visiting him at the asylum. which she wouldn't have done had she not known that he was her brother. Now, of course, in the first film, she doesn't know this guy wearing a mask is Michael Myers. But when once Last Starfighter tells her, "Yeah, Michael Myers," she's like, "Michael Myers." That's what sets it off, and then she has that weird reaction to the drugs where she's like comatose or for a few minutes, and then she has that flashback. Her mom says like, "I'm not your mom," or something like that. So those are absolutely right, John. Those she knew this. This was like a big revelation, which makes sense. Which kind of solves a potential plot hole where you're like, "Whoa, no one told Lori that Michael Myers was her brother in this whole movie." Right, because the other nurse tells Loomis this, the other doctor tells Loomis this in the car, and then we're like off to the finale, and it's all over. But there wasn't a big like, he's your brother revelation. It was all internal from her.
Okay,
that's why she says like Michael at the end. He like does this little head tilt for a second before he goes in for the kill again. So it's I find that interesting. Like it wasn't a revelation to her; it was a revelation to pretty much everybody else. In the film.
That's awesome. I never really considered that. Like I've seen these so many times that, when I start the film, when I start Halloween 1, like that motivation is there for me. Like when I watch it, because that's how I know that it plays out. That's really interesting. I never considered it that way. So excellent.
Yeah. The one thing I'll interject too is that, in terms of the relation and everything like that, it's really I think that it is it's something where Carpenter, if I recall correctly, has gone back and said that it's the product of writer's block, that he was having trouble and he's like, how am I going to make this work? The sequel sister, yeah, okay, that's the way it's going to work. And so I believe even Carpenter has disavowed it since, it like not disavowed but sort of like not really wanted to claim complete ownership of it as a good idea. And I think that's a shame in and of itself, because you can get some real moments of inspiration when your back is up against the wall, and to turn around and retroactively say, "No, I'm not really nuts about it either." That feels a little cheap, especially because this is where I'll throw him under the bus a little bit. With the first one, there was some edition that was issued where they said color corrected with, John Carpenter at the helm. First and foremost, only accept your color corrections if Dean Cundey's name is on it. But he apparently signed off on it, and I have a friend who was at a horror convention where somebody said, "Well, your approved version has this, has sort of like a more orange tint to, certain shots, whereas Cundey's approved version has more bluish." And Carpenter himself said, I haven't even watched the thing in a long time. Sure, I don't know. And so, I think that sometimes filmmakers, Carpenter included, and I'll even, and Lucas as well, can sometimes, you can sort of rewrite your own history in your brain sometimes. And if I were Carpenter, I'd say, "No, it was a great inspiration. Thank you very much. And I'm fully on board, and you should thank me for having that crazy idea at 2 o'clock in the morning." So there you go.
Well, if he didn't have that connection, that's what his block was. He's like, "Well, I want to bring Jamie Lee Curtis back. She was, the last girl. She was the standout. And how do we keep, why would he keep going after this girl? Oh, this is how, right? This is why." Just to play what if, like, do you guys think a sequel would have worked with him just stalking the town some more without any returning characters like Jamie Lee Curtis?
I think that you could have given the motivation of why does he keep coming after her as it's unfinished business. He doesn't, you could say, to speak to your point earlier, Zach, he reenacts his whole fantasy, and if Lori doesn't go over, what happens? Right? Does he just sit there and wait to be found?
Right.
As a lot of psychopaths do, or serial killers, they do this whole thing and they just basically start giving clues to the cops like, "Hey, here, come and get me."
Mm-hmm.
And her getting away could very easily, they could have just said, "Yeah, he's not going to stop until he gets her, or we've turned him into nothing and scattered his ashes because she's unfinished."
Mm-hmm. I think it could have worked without... I don't know that it could have worked on the same night, but, maybe it could have. I mean, it could have... Probably could have worked. I mean, it just would have been a different ending, that's all, so...
Well, Jamie Lee Curtis, although she's top billed, she's only in this film for 25 minutes. and most of those, she's in a hospital bed.
Right.
So, it's like they went to all this convolution to bring her back, and they didn't really use her to the full extend as maybe they could have. Of course, you know, again, this is what we were talking about when we started the conversation. You lock yourself into this, and only so many options with the story, because she fell down a staircase, she got stabbed in the arm, right? You have to address those things.
Right.
And, you know, and this is what, and really bringing her back is what sets Halloween 2 apart from, you know, with like Friday the 13th Part 2 or Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2. You have a returning character, because a lot of the franchises, as you were saying earlier, Brandon, they would have the bad guy get away and then go terrorize another group of teenagers or something. Yeah, but this one, there's a real story here. And I think Dr. Loomis is what ties a lot of this together. And I love him in this movie probably even more than the first one, because he's got a lot more to do.
Right.
I feel like Dr. Loomis than just warning people. He's like he's going around. He almost shoots the Ben Tramer, you know, in the street. He holds up the cop at the end in the car. You know, he's like, dude, you people do a warning shot. He shoots out the window. I'm like, yeah, Loomis is hardcore. So I really loved Donald Pleasance in this one.
Yeah, he did a good job. You know, the interesting thing about Laurie is that she's very similar to her role in the first one, in that it's like all this death is going on around her, and she's not really involved until the end. And that same kind of thing happens in this film. You know, so it's kind of is a parallel of like how the format of the first movie went as well. So excellent. Right on. Well, let's wrap her up here. Zach, why don't you give us, you'd come up with a little bit of trivia on the film itself. I wanted to do that at the beginning, but we just kind of dived right into the discussion there. So Zach, why don't you give us a little bit of trivia points for the film?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as I joked about in my intro for myself at the top of the podcast, if you watch Halloween, Loomis shoots Michael Myers 6 times, right? Because he's got a revolver. But in Halloween 2, there's 7 shots when we reenact it. So I guess he's got that 6-shooter special from that Sulu has in Shore Leave, where it shoots 7 bullets, even though there's only 6. Anyway, that's a deep cut Star Trek reference for you. But anyway, that's a little bit of a reenactment fun there. Also, you know, the mask here, by the way, the mask has never looked better from the first or second movie. I think it might be even better in the second movie, the Michael Myers mask. This is the same exact mask, but it had kind of aged over time, got a little dirtier. You know, there's lots of stories about why. Some say Deborah Hill kept it under her bed, one of the writers and producers of the first film, the second film, and it got like smoke on it, so it turned kind of yellow. But it's the same mask, and they've never recaptured the look of this mask, in my opinion.
Is it the same one? Because to me, I thought it looked different.
No, Zach's right. It aged a little bit, but it is the same one. And it is so maddening how far they got away. Like everyone that he came back since. And I mean, Halloween H2O is the worst because they had something like 3 masks in it or something. But they've never recaptured that magic. And that's the thing that I'm hoping most for. I'm sorry to have jumped in, Zach. Like,
oh, no, absolutely.
If they can make the mask look right in this new one, then I will forgive throwing out everything else, because, man, that's going to count for something.
Well, having it be the same exact mask and age, I think, will help it in that point. But anyway, and then, Brandon, to your point, looking a little different, it wasn't Nick Castle this time. It was Dick Warlock. It was a different actor. So it maybe fit his face a little bit differently.
So but see, I figured that, too, that they must have had a different person, because when they showed the scenes from the first movie, they didn't show Michael Myers' face. They purposely cut around it, right, when they were doing the recap of the previous film.
Well, that wasn't even Nick Castle. That was a completely different actor, just for that one shot of him taking his mask off, which I forget his name. That escapes me. But anyway, there are lots of people that play Michael Myers over the years. Another bit of trivia I thought was interesting is Annie from Halloween, the first one, right? She reprises her role in this one as a corpse in Halloween 2, because her dad sees her, and it's very sad moment there. She's also the voice on the telephone when the girl who gets stabbed like the first person that Michael kills in this film, she's the one like, you know, on the other side of the phone. She also says totally, which I thought was a fun reference to the first movie as well. But yeah, and then, you know, Rick Rosenthal, we talked a little bit about him. He actually went on to direct Halloween Resurrection.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to.
Such a good
movie. Get to that one in a few weeks.
Spoilers.
He also directed 7 episodes of Smallville, which is my favorite show. So I just want to throw that out there. And then, you know, they shot at a real hospital.
Okay.
For this one, you wonder, like, man, they had a lot of hallway sets or whatever. But yeah, this movie was filmed at Morningside Hospital in South Harvard Street in Los Angeles, and it had recently closed, and so they had access to pretty much use anything. And then it has since been torn down, so no set visits here, guys. And then, you know, we mentioned earlier, John, you brought it up first, but Dana Carvey made his on-screen debut in this movie, which, hey, he went on to fame in Wayne's World, co-starring with who? Mike Myers. It's all connected. So I'll leave you with that.
I love it. Excellent. Right on. John, did you have any final thoughts on the film, and did you want to give your rating of it?
Sure. One thing I'll interject in terms of it being a different person, Dick Warlock playing Michael, I remember distinctly, because I was one of those troubled kids that read Fangoria magazine. There was an interview with him years later where they asked him how he got the part, and apparently like the mask was like laying there and he had put the mask on just, you know, just as a giggle sort of thing, and apparently scared a secretary so badly that they basically said to him, "You got it." Like, they apparently he stood there right or something like that. Who knows if that's him remembering differently,
right,
over the years.
It's in part of the Halloween lore. Who knows, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, and God help me trying to find the issue where he said that. But I will say that Halloween 2 is a worthy sequel. It is by no means the best, and that's just because, I mean, the original Halloween is essentially like the Raiders of the Lost Ark of this series. You started off perfect, and you're never going to get back there. And the closest you can do is just make it worth my time to watch a sequel. And I think Halloween 2 succeeds with that. You know, it's good enough. And the thing is, that sounds dismissive. I mean that as a sense of praise. It's good enough for me to want to watch it and accept it as a sequel. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the best praise you can give something that's serving up a, you know, as a follow up like that.
Mm-hmm. Zach, any final thoughts? You have a rating for the film?
Yeah, final thought. Have you ever seen a hospital more empty than this hospital? I mean, I'm just going to say, I think he kills all 10 staff members. There's no one left. So, anyway, that's just a thought I had. But John, you said it perfectly. Like, if they were going to make a sequel to this, right, this justifies its own existence, which is something that's rare. Especially for a horror sequel. Horror franchises traditionally just, there is a steep decline, right, with sequels. And fortunately, that wasn't the case here with Halloween 2. You can't beat the first one, right? But I think we rated it, out of 5 jack-o'-lanterns last time, Brandon?
Sure,
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Is that our rating system? So I would rate Halloween 2, I would say 3.5 out of 5 jack-o'-lanterns for Halloween 2.
3.5 out of 5. Okay. John, did you want to give it a rating?
I'm right on line with Zach. I think 3.5 is spot on.
Excellent. Well, I love this film. I think it's a worthy successor as a sequel. I think it's done really well. I don't think it's a better made film, but I think I definitely have more fun watching this movie than I do the first one because of some of the stuff that I said. I definitely give this one 5 out of 5 jack-o'-lanterns. And, you know, this is the first time in a long time that I've watched it. And I had a lot of fun watching it again this time, and I'm really glad that we're doing this rewatch, and it's great, and I couldn't ask for more, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they're doing when they reboot the sequel. I think it's really interesting, and it's going to be fun to check out and see what they do. John, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you and tell them about Great Shot Kid?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You can find me as Kessel Junkie out there online, usually trolling around on Twitter. You can find me on the Nerd Party Network, as you said, Brandon, co-hosting Great Shot Kid with Mike Schindler, where we look at behind-the-scenes stuff, and I'm trying to drag him kicking and screaming into watching the Halloween movies and getting those completed before. Hey, listen, if he was willing to try The Purge, he should be willing to do this. Just as an aside, he considers Rob Zombie's Halloween the best one of the series. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And you can find me also on the Nerd Party Network co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with Matthew Rushing, and Floating Out in the Ether co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig.
And for the listeners as well, I'm going to see if I can find out which episode number it is. If you like the Halloween films, and you should check out you guys, you don't number your episodes anymore.
No, we do not.
Oh, that's too bad.
No, we do not.
So there was do you remember the name of the episode? What Can We Learn from Horror? Here we go. So the June 15th episode of Great Shot Kid from June 15th, 2018, What Can We Learn from Horror? You should definitely check it out because you and Mike have a really great discussion about fandom in general and like this toxic fandom that's out there right now and how horror fan films don't tend to go that way with their fandom, even though the movies tend to get worse and worse all the time and whatnot. And it's a really interesting discussion. So I definitely check it out. I retweeted saying, even if you don't like Halloween, you should, if you consider yourself a fan of any franchise, you should listen to this episode because it does put some perspective into some of the fan response into certain series of films right now.
Thanks, man.
Zach, where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. I'm also a host of my own podcast, Always Sold in a Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of the Young Superman show, seven of which were directed by Halloween 2's director, Rick Rosenthal. So you can find us on Twitter at Always Smallville with one S. I'm also a host of Standard Orbit on the Trek FM network. You can find us on Twitter at Trek FM. I co-host the original series of Star Trek podcast there with Ken Tripp and Haley Stoddard. We talk about all things old and new, Captain Kirk and the Enterprise.
Excellent. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. And as for my podcast, I have one on the Fandom Podcast Network called Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast, where we go through Hitch's films one at a time with my friends Chris and Tom. And on Trek FM, I have two podcasts. One's called Warp 5 with my friends Brandy and Patrick, where we talk about Star Trek Enterprise. And I've just revived Melodic Treks, which is a Star Trek music podcast. As of recording of this, I've just revived it. But this was obviously 2 months ago because we're recording this on June 30th. Here tonight. Thank you so much to Marcelo Pico for hosting this podcast series for us on his website, The Talk Film Society. Check out his feed for podcasts because there's lots of great stuff all the time. And until next week, it's only 7 more days till Halloween, Zach, till Halloween 3. 7 more days till Halloween 3. Halloween 3. Halloween 3. Bum, 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 bum.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Bum, 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 bum. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Bum, 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 bum. Give him 2 lips like roses and clover. Bum, bum, bum. Then tell him that.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention the music. Yeah, Mr. Sandman was in this one. We did forget to mention that.
Why is that in here? Why is. Does anybody know?
Why not?
It's a good explanation to city. I love it. I love the juxtaposition of that, right? Especially at the end. But an odd song choice, but I love it all the same.